Who the Wild Things Are with Ryan McGuire.
You gotta listen to your body.
Oh my God, maybe, you know, I could get out there. I could do this.
Let's take a ride. Find your wild side. Real stories. See with your own eyes.
It's so beautiful.
I'm gonna have the best time out here.
Yeah, I was in tears. I was just like, that's the best, man.
Welcome back to Who the Wild Things Are. My name is Ryan McGuire, and I'm here to bring you conversations with the most wild folks on the planet. If you're enjoying the podcast, please leave us a rating and review on your podcast platform of choice. And if you enjoyed the episode, share it with a friend. Appreciate you guys. Let's get it going. All right, Mike. Well, stoked to have you back. And I guess if folks haven't listened to episode one with Mike, they should go do that now before we get into all the things you've been up to since that episode.
Cool.
What's been going on, man?
Not too much besides launching The Offense, which is my new coaching business. So it's been pretty fun to get that going off the ground. And it's a culmination of the past 15 years of all of my coaching. So doing a lot of like just the branding for it has been cool, like the websites and the logos and all of that stuff. And yeah, stoked on the response so far from people.
Sweet. So what's the difference from The Offense and the coaching offering that you've offered previously?
Not too much, just more of an easier way to understand it.
Gotcha.
Right? Like before it's Mike Idella Coaching, and now it's The Offense, which essentially is helping people live a life on offense, which is on more like an aggressive type of stance. Like you're a great example of this, where you attack life. Like I'm looking behind me here at your world record.
Oh,
whereas a lot of the folks that I'll work with maybe play in a more defensive position where they're nervous, they're fearful, they're not quite don't have quite as much confidence to go after their dreams or ambitions. And so The Offense, which is really what I've just been helping people do, is take action.
Yeah, that's a cool premise, and it makes it very easy to understand when you think about, all right, are you on offense or defense, like in a normal sport in life?
Yeah, that's really the key, because it's difficult to quite understand coaching sometimes.
Yeah.
Like I was talking to my mom the other day about this, and like her mom, my grandma, if you say, I need to go to the doctor, or I'm going to visit my doctor, she's like, cool, that makes sense. But if you say, I'm going to go see my, you know, performance mindset coach, she's like, what the heck is that? And so being able to explain it in a way that makes sense is really important.
Yeah, no, that's huge, especially for, I feel like the environment that we live in, like you're in Boulder and there's so many folks that are like trying to shoot for the stars and trying to achieve all these big aspirations, but maybe they don't know where to start.
Right. Yeah.
It can be daunting for sure.
It really is. I think a lot of people want to have, they have big aspirations. Usually they get kind of shut down at some point in their life, and then there becomes a point, usually in midlife, where they're not really sure what it is that they want to go do. And so a lot of the work that I do on The Offense is helping people explore what could be possible for them, what they would actually enjoy doing, which is a fun kind of exploration that I get to do.
Yeah, I definitely went through that in my life at one point, and then I feel like the last, I don't know, 10 years have been focused mostly on the wilderness and sport. Mm-hmm. And the combination of those two things. The interesting thing is once you figure out what it is,
yeah,
there's still a lot of work to do, you know?
Oh, it's, yeah.
Like, that's the beginning.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, I think it's always evolving. Like I'm very different now than I was 5 years ago or 10 years ago. But the premise of how I try and live my life on offense is the same. And so if, you know, if I got injured, knock on wood, and couldn't do things physically, which is one way I like to express myself, I would take action towards maybe something more artistic or different aspects that I'm also interested, just maybe not as much at this moment.
Mm. Yeah, you have a different path because you were like strongman, you know, like known as being able to do these incredible feats of strength, and then kind of a right-hand turn into the ultra world. And yeah, I don't think that that's typically something that people associate together.
Right, yeah.
That's what happens. Giant, strong dudes.
When you live in Boulder, Colorado.
yeah, for sure. There's definitely a culture for it here. Mm-hmm. So let's dig into your ultra path a little bit. I know last time we dove in deep on kind of like zone two and how you were doing that transition. Mm-hmm. And now I would say you have, you know, run several ultras. Some have gone great. Some have not gone as planned. I want to dive into some of those a little bit.
Cool.
One of the reasons that I have a podcast is that I get to learn from people that I want to learn from about subjects that I'm interested in. One race that I'm doing this year is Leadville 100. You're also doing it, and you did it last year. And so I'd love to just like dig into your experience with it a little bit.
Cool.
See if there's anything that stands out there.
Yeah, definitely. So I've done maybe, I don't know, it's more than 10 ultras. I've attempted 200 milers and completed one of them. I think the same weekend you did yours.
Yeah.
And then Leadville last year, not really quite sure where you want me to start. I basically didn't make, you have to make certain time cutoffs at Leadville, and the first half of the race, they're really strict. So what makes Leadville tricky is you have to kind of push in the first 62 miles. And then there's Hope Pass in the middle, which is this huge, like 7,000 foot gain over 22 mile chunk right after you've already run 38 miles. And so you go out to Winfield, which is like really beautiful small mining town that it's not even really a town, it's just like dropped in the middle of the in the valley, and then turn around and come right back up and over Hope Pass. And so for me, I was so nervous about the second half of the race because I'd ran 100k before, which is 62 miles, but nothing beyond that. And I have some history with like a sleeping disorder when I was younger, so I was nervous that I'd get tired or wouldn't be able to make it through the night. And so everyone was telling me, don't go out too hot, take your time, and then save some stuff for the second half of the race. Well, I wound up saving too much for the second half of the race. I was, I think, 220 pounds on race day and didn't leave myself enough time to come back up and over Hope Pass.
Okay.
And so it was pretty detrimental for me mentally at that moment as I make the turnaround at Winfield with like 10 minutes to spare. And then, you know, I'm starting to go back and you know, run along the, it's kind of like a small climb that's runnable before you hit like a very steep incline to go up and over the pass. And I'm passing all of these people who are not going to make the cutoff at Winfield, so their day is going to be over. And they're cheering you on. But then all of a sudden they kind of run out and you're by yourself because I'm in the back of the pack. And I just get to that point where I forget exactly how steep it is. I think it's like a little bit over 2,000 feet in like 2 miles or so. But it's at, you know, 12,500 feet. So there's a lot of altitude and your heels don't touch the ground. You're kind of just going straight up. And I needed to keep a pretty decent clip in order to make it to the top of the pass and then down. And as I got toward the top, I was like hanging over the poles, just like, I'm not going to make it. And there was just a moment where I realized that I wasn't going to make it. And just, there was a couple other people around me that were also realizing that. And we had our own little pity party with each other for like 5 minutes. And then we knew there was an aid station on the backside of that. And so we were like, let's just make it to that aid station. You know, hang out by the fire for a second because it got dark then, and then just finish our hike down.
Yeah. So if I'm not mistaken, that first part, kind of before you get to Hope Pass, it's kind of, it is a high elevation, but it's like pretty flat. So in theory, you could open up and like start Leadville pretty fast.
Yeah. So let's see. I can break it down by aid stations. So there's the start to May Queen, which is basically a half marathon, a little bit less. And the beginning of the race is downhill. And so like the first 4 miles, you can really go fast. I mean, you're going downhill. I was holding myself back to not go down so fast. And then you run around Twin Lakes, or excuse me, Turquoise Lake to get to May Queen. And so it's like a little bit of elevation. I think it's like 800 feet over the 13 miles, so not that bad. After that, you do a climb up to the top of Powerline, which is the same route that they do the bike race on. And then you go down Powerline into Outward Bound, which is mile 24, 25. And then from there to Twin Lakes is like 13 or 14 miles and like 14 to 1,500 feet of gain, I believe. I might be off by like a couple hundred feet. But it's a steady uphill. And so it's not flat, but it's not a hike, like crazy steep. For me, that was my first time, and I was really nervous about getting my heart rate too high. And so that was the crux of the race, where I really needed to push in those in that period. Yeah. And it was uphill enough that I couldn't run with keeping my heart rate in a low zone. So I had to like power hike it at 13, 14 minute miles. And if I just ran it at 11 or 12, I would have given myself enough time to finish Hope Pass.
Gotcha. And you've been able to kind of go back and dissect this race and be like, okay.
Very much so. Very much so.
I'm curious, and I don't want to like twist the sword in too much because I've like had races not go my way and that stuff sucks. But for you, you seem like such a level-headed guy with mm-hmm. like a very introspective mindset. I'm curious what like facing failure in that moment was like for you, because for me it's like I feel like my life is in shambles and everything's falling apart, but I don't know for a Zen master like you if it goes the same way.
I mean, what's cool about doing these races is, you know, try not to link everything back to offensive theme, but you are putting yourself out there, and you can only, you know, win in life if you try. If you guys shoot the ball, you got to sign up for the race, you got to put yourself in the game in order to have the opportunity to win. But on the flip side of that is you can lose. Mm-hmm. And so I don't necessarily view it as a loss now. I definitely afterwards it was super tough, and you're trying to play all these mental games with yourself on understanding what it is. But I'm very good at figuring out a story that then I can lean on, mm-hmm. and then like not let it completely destroy me. Like the first 48 hours were really tough because I was, you know, wanted to finish, put a bunch of time and effort and money and energy and talked about it with my family and my friends and came on podcasts and talk about how I'm going to do this race. And then all of a sudden it doesn't go the way that I thought I wanted it to go. To be honest, the most brutal part, which I'm glad I did this because it's like ingrained in my head now, is so I came back down to Twin Lakes at mile 62, and then my whole family's there, right? Mm-hmm. They'll recognize that I'm not going to make it, or that I didn't make it. It was way past then. And then we drive the truck back, sleep for a little bit, wake up at like 8:30 in the morning, and then decide to walk to the finish line. So our house was like pretty close to the finish line. So we walk over towards the finish line, and now you see everyone coming in with their whole crew. And it was just like waterworks for me. I just like had my sunglasses on. I was like just crying because I'm so happy for these people that are finishing. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, that needs to be me. Like that was supposed to be me and it's not. And so that was a cool moment in one way, because I don't get to experience that kind of doubt or like failure often, mm-hmm. especially on that big of a scale, at least in my own head. Like, you know, I wasn't coming close to winning the race or thinking of anything like that, but I really had built it up in my own head, which I like doing. It makes it fun and kind of puts it on the line a little bit more.
Yeah, it makes it more meaningful, but it also makes it higher stakes.
Yeah, but also I think the meaningful thing is the case, right? Because, okay, I don't finish the race. I'm down for a little bit of time. And then I have the amazing opportunity to try again.
Yeah.
And to like write that failure in any way that I want. And, you know, this super cliche, but it's like I really try to think I don't ever fail at anything. I just learn and then I can come back and do something different, which is what I'm going to do this year.
Do you write the story in your head while you're running the ultra? Has that ever happened to you? And maybe this is just something that happens to me, but essentially like while I'm running an ultra or any multi-day event or anything, like my brain is kind of like weaving and writing a story, like this happened and then this happened and this really held me back, but then I got another jolt, and like as I'm going through the adventure I can hear my brain like weaving this story.
Yeah, my brain does a lot of things at that time. It's a lot of time. I don't consciously think about like weaving that type of story, but I'm sure that I do, and I'm trying to think about it. Like, okay, I didn't go as fast as I wanted to in that section, so now I got to pick it up a little bit here. You know, different games like that. I'm constantly playing micro and macro games depending on, you know, how I'm feeling or how focused I am.
Yeah, those are one of the interesting things to let develop in your mind, especially as you get tired. Like, I don't know, just little things like getting to the next tree.
Oh yeah.
Or just like trying to focus on moving just like your right foot and just letting your left foot come with it, and it's just like, or yeah, just little weird games that you play with yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm, as I imagine similarly to you, can just get hyper-focused on one thing, and then just that's helpful in a long race like this, because I can just repetitively focus on my breathing or my exhales or my foot strike, and then before I know, I've just ran 3 miles. Mm. And then I'm like, okay, cool. Aid station's 2 more miles away. Let me, you know, just enjoy those or focus on something else or chat with someone that's close to me or try to catch someone in front of me or whatever it could be.
Yeah, it's funny with ultra, like the 2 weeks, maybe 3 weeks leading up to it, I'm practicing more, I don't know if you're similar, but more like mindset than I am really thinking about running.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just like trying to think about like, okay, when it sucks, like what kind of things am I going to rely on, like getting mm-hmm. to that next station or reminding yourself that you're not gonna die. Like that is that is one I use a lot, where it's like, yes, my legs hurt, yes, I'm tired, maybe even a little dehydrated, but I'm not gonna die, I can keep going. Like yeah. all you gotta do is keep going, and just like training that mindset before the race, so that when you get there and you get hit in the face and you get kicked down in the dirt, you're like, oh no, remember, we practiced the mindset for this, we have the tool in our toolkit to handle this situation.
Totally. Yeah. That was one I didn't do with Leadville. I didn't practice a mindset of not being able to finish it. So that was all new. When I recognized I wasn't going to make it, I was like, oh man, this is a, I didn't plan for it to go this way. I'm not sure how I'm going to talk to, you know, my partner as she's coming up to get me, or my family or anything else. And so, you know, when I can slow down on some other races if I have a longer, you know, period to the next aid station, or I can focus on food or something else. But not planning for the failure was just made it a little bit more difficult.
With all that said,
mm-hmm.
you have this tremendous learning experience. What has been different this time in terms of training? What are you doing differently? Eating differently, sleeping differently, different mindset. What's the change?
So I decided to double down on Leadville this year and do the Lead Challenge, which is, Leadville is a race series that was bought by Lifetime Fitness, which is a huge gym, and they put on all of these different races throughout the summer. And so there's a trail marathon that has like 6,000 plus feet of gain, like a pretty intense marathon. Then there's a 50-mile run with like 7,000, the 50-mile mountain bike ride, which is the same course, and then the 100-mile mountain bike ride, a 10K, and then the 100-mile run. And so to do the Lead Challenge, you have to complete all of the races within the time cap. And if you don't complete one of them, then you're out of the challenge. And so I was like, all right, if I'm going to be wanting to do the 100-mile run, I like mountain biking too. Like, let's double down and go for all of them. And so that's the biggest change, is now understanding that I have all of these races to kind of go for. And just continuing to kind of put in the time on my feet. And also I'm a lot fitter now this year. Like last year was, I just started kind of zone 2 aerobic training. And so it was, I didn't necessarily think of it this way, but it was probably a pretty audacious goal to go for Leadville as my first 100 miler. And now I can see myself being a lot fitter than I was at this point last year, even before the Leadville race.
Mm.
So that's where, like, you know, some tracking devices like a Garmin or a Strava can be helpful, because I can see my fitness level based on my pace and my heart rate from last year, and then see what it is now on certain training runs, and that it's already improved like tremendously.
Yeah, I've been stalking your Strava a little bit. You've been looking dangerous. I was like, damn, okay, Mike's not playing around this year.
Yeah, I'm trying, man. Yeah, doing a lot more vert, to answer your question. So last year was a lot of like just time on my feet, but a little bit flatter. Mm-hmm. And this time, basically, I have like 2 loops that I do from my house. One's like a flatter loop, and then one I can gain some elevation pretty quickly to like, not a ton, but like over 100 feet a mile.
Mm-hmm.
And I've noticed that that's helped a lot with, because it's kind of like built-in speed work.
Yeah.
But I'm also able to keep my heart rate down and, you know, run uphill, which it was never the case last year.
Yeah. Are you going over like by the flat irons, like that area?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Those are great running trails. And to your point, if you're able to work on running uphill, you save yourself actually a lot of impact, which to a non-runner, that sounds like counterintuitive. It sounds brutal to run uphill, but the brutal impact comes from running fast downhill. Like that's when you're banging up your knees and your back. But like when you're able to do uphill work, that actually, like you're saying, is disguised speed work.
Totally. yeah,
low impact speed work.
Totally, yeah. I mean, I went a little bit crazy with I mean, it was a little too dangerous with my training so far. I put in like quickly up to like 60-mile weeks, so like 100 feet of vert a week, and was bombing downhills. And so there's this there's small town called Gold Hill. It's like a little community at the top of Boulder. And so you run up to Gold Hill and then come down. It can be like a 15 or 20-mile run with like 3,000 to 4,500 feet of vert. So it's a big run. Yeah. But mentally in my head, I didn't think of it as like that big of a run, something that I would like the Five Peak Traverse, which is around the same distance, a little bit more vert, that I would be like, okay, this is like what I'm going to do, you know, once a month.
Or the Boulder Skyline. Yeah.
Yeah. But I did Gold Hill like 4 times in 1 week or in 10 days. And when I was going downhill, I was just letting my body go. I was like, cool, my legs are strong. I can just fall and bomb downhill. And I was like, my heart rate was able to stay low. So I was like looking at my watch, like, wow, 7-minute miles downhill, zone 1, 2. Like, oh, heck yeah, I'm killing it. And then I did some run in Fairplay over a spring break, and I got this crazy pain on the outside of my knee that like hobbled me, and I couldn't run at all. I couldn't even put any weight on it, and I got super nervous. And this was like 2 weeks ago. I've only done 2 runs since. I have a 50K this upcoming weekend, but I did a White Rim mountain bike trail with some buddies, and that's a 100-mile mountain bike ride in Moab, like throughout Canyonlands. And my knee was okay there, but to your point, it's a lot of impact. And that downhill, basically what I figured out yesterday with this PT and Boulder, is that when I strike the ground, that came to the outside of my hamstring, and that like muscle got really inflamed and was causing a little bit of pain there. And so working on running downhill technically with like a shorter, quicker stride to take kind of less pounding off of my knee, basically.
Yeah, it is. It's tough. Like that's my favorite thing to do is run downhill. It is the most fun part of trail running, but you do have to be careful with it. It's like you can get a little in over your head.
I think the technical stuff is probably safer for me because I can't go as fast. Like this Gold Hill, it's like a dirt road, and it's a road. So like cars drive on it 40 miles an hour, and there's basically nothing that you have to think about technically with it. So you can kind of just let your body like fall and fly. And, you know, I'm newish to running, so that's what I did and paid the price on it. And so those 2 training runs I've done between then have just been like a lot higher cadence.
Yeah.
And it doesn't bother me as much. And so for this upcoming race, you know, I was a little bummed because I wanted to like really push the 50K because I actually feel like, you know, I can put up a decent time for me and like PR it, but I'm gonna take it a little bit easy now on some of those downhills, and then if I feel good in the second half of the race, just, you know, let it fly.
Yeah, it is crazy because, so I mean, I'm relatively new to running too. I just got a coach like the end of last year for the first time, and he's so big on like, hey, if your body's tired, make sure you're doing your threshold work uphill. And he'll do like, we'll do threshold work where we're doing 6 minutes uphill and the rest is the 2-minute downhill, like back to where you started. And for me, I never even considered that would lower the impact while hitting kind of like the same heart rate ranges. I never even realized that. I just thought you ran as hard as you could for as long as you could, as often as you can. and now I'm realizing that you're not supposed to do that.
No. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's interesting. And I'm curious, are you working with a coach or are you just doing your own programming?
Yeah. I work with Ryan Kroll. He runs Boundless Coaching. Okay. It's like the official coaching of Leadville.
Oh, nice. So does that, you get a coach through the Lead Challenge?
You don't get a coach through it, but he has a service that Leadville recommends.
Oh, cool.
A lot of his coaches have done the mountain bike rides, the runs, the Lead Challenge. Like Ryan's done all 3 of those multiple times. And so it's helpful because he knows the course. So when he programs runs for me, it will be like a Hagerman's Pass mountain bike ride or a you know, Turquoise Lake run that like kind of mimics the terrain.
Wow, that's so nice.
Yeah.
I feel like that's such a confidence builder. You're like, I'm literally going straight race specificity on all these workouts.
Yeah, it's helpful because he can kind of be like, well, if you can do Hope's Pass in this amount of time, then You just need to get there at this time, and you just reverse engineer things, which makes a lot of sense on a race. And this is a lot of the same work I do with my clients in the offense. It's like reverse engineer wherever it is that they want to do to help get out of their own head, so that they can make plans and feel like they're accomplishing that whatever 100-mile run race is for them in, say, their business or their relationship or something.
Yeah, even the coaches need coaches.
Oh, yeah.
It's cool to see, and I think it's admirable that you're just doubling down. You're like, I don't care what happened last year. I'm gonna go get it.
Yeah, which, thanks, dude.
It's funny because our other friend Joey, who ended up finishing, and I think going into it, people probably sold him short because he's from Florida, and people are like, Joey, I don't know what's gonna happen. And then, man,
that was like. So I ran with Joey the first like third of the race, and I'm a coach, so I love helping people. And I thought the exact same thing with Joey. I'm like, this guy's a golden retriever. He needs to just be held back so he can not blow up and try to go out too fast. And so I don't necessarily regret this, but this year I'm not going to be doing this. Like, I focused a lot on like holding him back, and I think I was nervous. And so when I get nervous in the middle beginning of race, I go towards something I'm comfortable with, which is like coaching and supporting someone else. And I'm so pumped for him. I mean, he pulled away from me in that middle position because he could run uphill and keep his heart rate down, where I couldn't. And I was like, okay, you go, I'll meet you at wherever. But yeah, man, he crushed it. I think there is something to be said about the heat and the humidity as really helpful.
Yeah, and he has a wrestler background. I don't sell wrestlers short on anything they do in life. Yeah. They're just pit bulls, dude. They're just dogs. Like,
yeah,
they just can be so scrappy. Mm-hmm. When you're going through that as a seventh grader and you're going through three a days, like in a sweaty gym, and you're just like fighting grown men, like those guys just come up different.
Yeah.
I think, yeah, just different breed of human beings.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, this year, for me, it's like a race to Twin Lakes, getting back to there. Because if you can get back there, the time cutoffs like dramatically shift, where you can theoretically walk it in,
right,
for the last 38 miles, which is still hard. I mean, there's a lot, and you got to kind of can't walk everything. Like, you got to be moving, but you got to get there in like, I think like 15 minute mile average or something, and then afterwards you get to average like 20 minute miles.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever thought about going for the big buckle?
Definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah, why not?
Is that on your mindset this year?
I think that's going to be like a more game time decision.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't want to focus on that and then mess up something on like the mountain bike ride. And so focusing on like the first race is what I'm going to really try and do. Like, and what's difficult about it is, you'll appreciate this. Excuse me. The trail marathon is the last weekend in June, the June 29th, on Saturday. The next weekend is the 50-mile run. The next day is the 50-mile mountain bike ride. And so you don't have to do that for the lead challenge, but, you know, some of the Leadville locals are like, to do like the real lead challenge, like, you kind of got to do Silver King, which is like both the mountain bike and the run.
In theory, so, you only have to do 50-mile bike or 50-mile run.
But there's like, you know, people are like, yeah, you could also do both and like gain some like respect in that kind of way. And yeah. So I respect anyone that does whatever it is that challenges them. Like, but for me, I was like, okay, that's motivating for me. I'll give that a go.
Yeah.
And so yeah, it's basically three huge events in, you know, one week.
Yeah. That's a lot of mileage and a lot of vert.
A lot of vert, yeah. And then, so after the 50-mile, I'm planning on doing the 50-mile mountain bike ride. I'm going to go harder on the 50-mile run. But then I'll do the bike just to get comfortable in bike racing, especially at altitude. And then 3 weeks later is the 100-mile mountain bike ride.
Right.
On a Saturday. Sunday's a 10K. And then 5 days later is the 100-mile run.
It's a big summer.
Big summer.
A lot of time in Leadville.
Totally. Yeah.
I feel like you got to get like a summer house up there.
I know. I thought about it.
Yeah. That'll be fun though. Leadville's beautiful. It's a great place to be. Like, if you got to spend your summer somewhere, and Leadville's a pretty good spot.
Yeah. I mean, I totally feel lucky to live, you know, 2 hours close to it. So I can go up, like the trail marathon, I'll go up the night before, probably camp out, do the run, and then come back home.
Mm-hmm.
The three bigger weekends after that, I'll be staying up there. But I'm planning on coming back home down to Boulder after the 100-mile mountain bike ride, just to really work on recovering. I don't sleep the best at altitude and recover well there. So after the 100-mile bike, run the 10K the next day, come home, sleep, try and recover, and then head back up on Friday, like the day before the 100-mile run.
Yeah. I've thought about that too. I'm trying to think. It looks like I'm just looking at my calendar, but I think it's 2 weeks. Yeah, 2 weeks beforehand. Have you ever heard of the Collegiate Loop?
Mm-hmm.
So 2 weeks beforehand, we're going to run the Collegiate Loop, which it's going to be full on, 160 miles.
Wait, you're running 160 miles 2 weeks before the 100 mile?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's interesting move.
I feel like it's fine.
Okay.
Yeah.
How long is that going to take you?
I think we're shooting for 4 days.
Okay.
Yeah, I think the FKT is like sub two, maybe. Mm-hmm. I think Courtney DeWalter has the FKT.
Dang.
But 4 days would be 4 40-mile, so basically four ultras in a row.
Why at that time?
That was the only day my friend could do it, or like the weekend my friend could do it.
Got it.
And he wants that to be like his big effort. I would string it out to a week and be fine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I like the idea of it because I feel like 40 is like not crazy mileage, but I really just want to sleep up high. Mm-hmm. And that gives me like the assurance that I'm going to be sleeping at 11,000 feet every night.
Mm-hmm.
Especially leading up to that, because the gains you get like from like a oxygen perspective, sleeping up high beforehand and then running Leadville is pretty huge.
Definitely.
So while it might beat me up a little bit, I'm just going to come back and try and chill after that in between Leadville.
Nice. So you have like 2 weeks to recover.
Yeah, at least like 12 days.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll just take it super easy.
Nice.
And it's like, it's not a race. Like if something happens during the 4 days, like I tweak something, then I'll just chill.
Mm-hmm.
And hike around and do whatever.
Right.
I don't need to like set any records or anything, but it could be just a beautiful little excursion.
Yeah, it definitely will be beautiful. That's for sure.
Yeah, I've heard the western side of the Collegiate Peak is like one of the most beautiful places in Colorado, and then people kind of hate on the eastern side.
Mm.
I don't know if you've heard that, but it's like it kind of overlooks like Buena Vista, and there's like more cities. First, like west side is straight up like endless wilderness.
Okay, that
like
makes sense.
As far as you can see, every direction.
Yeah, that makes sense from when I've done the, there's a mountain bike ride I like to do there. I forget what it's called, but you're right on the Continental Divide, and so you can look out and see. Oh,
the one with...
The Monarch Crest Trail.
Yeah, Monarch Crest Trail.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think you might even touch that.
I bet.
On the Collegiate, on the Collegiate Loop. Yeah. And the Colorado Trail, obviously, comes right there, too.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of the intersection of all, like, these big trails in Colorado.
Yeah.
I love that area. If I live in Colorado forever, I see myself moving out towards the Collegiate Peaks for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's super beautiful.
You could never touch every part of it. It's just like endless wilderness.
Totally.
So tell me a little bit about this ultra you have this weekend. Where is it, and what are we looking at?
So it's Desert Rats. It's a 50K in Fruta.
Okay.
31 miles, like just under 4,000 feet, I think, of gain.
Okay.
And loss. And so I'm headed out there actually now. It's Thursday. So I'll get out there Friday, do some work, pick up my packet, and then the race starts at 7 a.m. And one thing that's actually been pretty interesting that I've changed around a lot since last year is my diet.
Mm-hmm.
Last year, or the beginning of like 2024, I was like almost 230 pounds. That's just like a lot of strength work. And, that's a lot to carry, at least what people have been telling me when you're running. And so I was like, all right, let me actually really try and drop some weight and see if it makes a difference. And so I've been experimenting with like changing my diet to more fat adaptation through like a more keto type of diet, where I basically did less than 50 grams of carbs a day for like 8 weeks. And I lost over 25 pounds.
Wow.
Yeah, I got down to like 202. right now I'm probably like 205, and I felt amazing. Like, I don't like telling people how to eat, but like, this is incredible. Just like steaks all the time, eggs, sausages, just like tons of fatty meat. And my runs felt great. I was like losing almost a pound a day.
Wow.
I do think that I kind of pushed it maybe a little bit too hard with some of the runs, and like not having the carbohydrates didn't aid in performance in terms of like recovery. But the speed really improved from being lighter. And so that's been cool. Now as I run, instead of thinking about like 100 grams of carbs an hour and just like sucking down spring energy gels, you know, doing about half of that. And so kind of a little bit less on the stomach, a little bit less on the GI. Not that I ever really have a lot of those issues, but like when you're running and trying to digest 300 calories an hour, over time it can really catch up. Like for a 100-mile race, like a 50K, which is crazy to think about, like Mike 3 years ago saying this, like it's like not that bad. Like, yeah. But it's still, you know, 31 miles that I'll be trying to hit like a, you know, 10 something per minute mile average. So different than my first 50K, it was like 14 minute miles,
right?
Like walking, you know, some of it. This one I'll really be trying to run as much as possible, and that mental shift is exciting and definitely different.
So let me see if I'm understanding this correctly with the fat adaptation. You're saying that because you're taking in fats so often in your diet,
mm-hmm.
that you don't need as many calories during your runs because your body's using that fat up, mm-hmm. and it's not requiring as much food intake.
Yeah, from what I understand, the story that I'm telling myself in my head, and it seems to be true based on the efforts that I've done, is that I can burn fat if I keep my intensity down. Mm-hmm. So I'm already doing that, keeping it in a lower zone.
Mm-hmm.
So then I'm just burning fat. Now I don't need to eat really until like 2 hours, 2.5 hours into an effort. And then I don't need to eat a ton. Just need to like, you know, if we think about building a fire, just like put a small log on, versus before it would be, okay, I got to start a fire out of something. You just throw some toilet paper in here, light that thing up, like boom, big fire, but then it burns out really fast. Mm-hmm. And then I got to do more paper or more newspaper or whatever it is. And so this is just like, you know, a steady burn throughout, not going to cause some huge effort, but at the same time, I'm not like sprinting at all during these races. And so when I do have carbs, they act as like, and I literally feel it like through my body as like a superpower.
Mm.
I have like a little gel or some rice and I'm just like, I can just go. It burns through. But then I go right back to the fat.
Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting. I don't know. I'm listening to what you're saying and like trying to figure out where I fall in that. Mm-hmm. So I definitely am, like you were saying, you're eating a lot of fatty meats and eggs, and mm-hmm. that's like the majority of my diet, and egg whites.
Mm-hmm.
But I definitely eat I eat carbs for running.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. Like I'll have an English muffin with grass-fed butter and mm-hmm. salt. And that's my superfood.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I can, because it literally, I don't even feel it in my stomach.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just enough carbs, fat from the butter, and the salt on top of it.
Yeah.
And that's like my go-to like pre-big run meal.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, but I don't know. I don't know what 50 carbs looks like, so it's hard for me to even think about. Mm-hmm, like
probably that.
That would be like 50? Okay.
Maybe, yeah. Like a banana is like 50 carbs.
A banana is 50 carbs. All right, just, so I'm way over.
The size of a banana, yeah.
I'm way over.
Like before, it really just depends on the goal. Like it's very easy to eat a lot of carbs super, super quickly. Like I was in Whole Foods the other day looking at different tuna salads, and there's like the cranberry tuna salad, or there's like the regular tuna salad, and the cranberry has cranberries in it. And that's like 20 grams of carbs in that mm-hmm. one little like 4 ounce container versus the other one that has two.
Mm.
And so it's easy to overeat in those carbohydrates. And from what I understand, your body needs time in a low, like, carb kind of situation for it to get into that fat adaptation. So I wanted to do it for like the 2 month period.
Yeah.
Really let it kind of transition over. And now, I mean, more importantly than running, it's completely changed my relationship with food. Like before, I would be so food motivated. Like it was almost embarrassing. I'd be like at the end of a run, just like thinking about like, okay, what's that meal I'm gonna crush? What are we having for dinner? Making sure it has enough carbs or energy. I viewed carbohydrates as energy, which they are, but I would overdo it.
Yeah,
it's as I'm sure a lot of people can relate to. It's easy to overeat pasta. It's hard to overeat steak.
Yeah, I think I don't eat a lot of pasta and bread, but I do eat a ton of fruit, like a lot of fruit. Mm-hmm. But for me, I always just think of that, like you're saying, as being like running fuel. Like I'll eat fruit a little bit before my runs, and I always just think of it as this is my version of, you know, candy or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, again, fruit's a healthy, like, it's healthy. It's kind of weird to think about it in this way because I'm definitely not saying not to eat fruit. But if you're wanting to build a more fat-adapted machine, which is a more efficient way to use your body's fuel,
mm-hmm.
then a certain period of time, and you can test this through, like, blood ketones and going to a lab and getting it done. I didn't do that. I just did it more anecdotally, like how I felt,
mm-hmm.
but you have to go without eating those things. And there was a time in the beginning, you know, if you're eating 300 or 400 carbs a day and then you go down to 50, you get hangry, like mm-hmm. you get, you know, you have some mood swings or I feel really low energy, and I felt that for like 3 to 4 days.
Mm.
And then I started to feel really amazing
because your body starts producing those ketones.
Exactly. And yeah. So now I feel like incredible. I don't have any moon swings in terms of the food. I don't get hangry. If I'm like, I haven't even eaten today, it's like noon and I'm not even thinking about food. Whereas yeah. in the past I'd be like, I have to eat before the podcast so I have energy, so I'm like able to focus and think about things, and then be thinking about it afterwards. And now, like, I'm good.
Yeah, it's just not the case.
It's just not the case.
One person that I heard talking about the ketosis thing, because I've been interested in it for a long time. I think I go into ketosis when I'm in the wilderness for a long time and I'm mm-hmm. eating mostly like fish
mm-hmm.
or fatty cuts of meat, and mm-hmm. there's no bread. Like sometimes you can get roots or something, but there's not a lot of carbs to be had.
Mm-hmm.
There's no like fruit bearing trees in Colorado, not right. naturally, really, maybe a little bit, but so I feel like my body has gone through that quite a few times.
Mm-hmm.
But I heard this person talking about it the other day, saying that most people think they're in ketosis and they're not, because mm-hmm. they're not taking in enough fat. And so she was pricking herself like 3 times a day
mm-hmm.
to check.
Yeah.
And I was like, dang, that's like, that's next level.
A lot of effort.
That is a lot of effort. 3 pricks a day just to see if you're producing ketones. Like, in order for her to be invested and continue to do this, mm-hmm. those ketones must be feeling good.
Yeah.
Like there's right, something right. she's getting out of that, or else she wouldn't be doing this.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, food's super emotional. And so like if you're asking someone to change their food, it's one of the hardest things that they can do. Often it's like a comfort, right? Like if you're stressed out, we go in and eat, or some type of vice. It's just a one that's not to go down like obesity pandemic or epidemic rabbit holes, but it's pretty clear that a lot of people might struggle with food. So if you're asking them to make those changes, it could make sense to me why someone would want to track and make sure that the changes that they're making are working.
Mm-hmm.
I like to kind of focus on just how I feel, how it makes my body feel, but I would definitely, you know, suggest to you as my friend, like explore what it feels like to do 50 grams or less of carbs, eat ribeyes every single night. And I felt amazing doing that and still mm-hmm. feel amazing doing that.
Maybe I need to go to the drawing board, because we have ribeyes every night, but we also eat a lot of carbs, so that's probably not.
You kind of got to pick one.
Yeah.
Like either, and what I tried to do for a while was low fat, and that was super hard.
I'm out like, on that one.
That was super hard, and now basically just going low carb and feel great. And then for a bigger effort, like this weekend, I'll start to eat some carbs. Like I started yesterday having some rice, some sweet potatoes, some different things like that.
Building it up. So I can
build up those reserves, but like a few days before, rather than just like always having reserves.
Mm.
And then I'll see how I feel during the race. But even with the 100-mile mountain bike ride that I did, it was like an 11-hour effort. And I never was like, I have to eat, like I'm dying. Like I just made sure to keep eating because I was burning, you know, 8,000 calories or more.
So are you going to be taking in more fats then during the race?
No.
You're just going to be carbing it up like you a normal ultra runner?
Like half of that.
But less overall calories during the race?
Yeah.
But you're not going to be like slamming whole milk and doing that kind of thing? Because like Mike McKnight, the low-carb ultra runner, he's an absolute dog. He has multiple elite FKT times.
Yeah.
That dude is like pretty much animal based and just like slams whole milk and freaking can run with anybody on the planet. Like put him in a 200 mile race, there's not many people who are going to beat him, period.
Right.
And he's taking in very little carbs, so it seems to be possible.
I think the term is like metabolically flexible. That's what I'm going for. I want to be able to have some of those carbs, just because at least the science that I've read, it is a superior energy source in certain instances. And so if I can have that and I can use that kind of like turbo boost here and there, I'll experiment with it. But also knowing that I have the backup of like, if I of being able to be supported just through fat, feels it just feels great.
Mm-hmm. And the way I understand it is that when you're at those lower heart rate zones, you're going to be burning fat. So, which makes sense evolutionarily. Like if you're walking around, you're hungry, you know, you're living in a village or a tribe that doesn't have that many calories, your body's burning fat, but you're like low heart rate.
Mm-hmm.
And then the carbs come in when it's like, oh, now we're going straight uphill. I can't control my heart rate anymore. I need those quick carbs to power through the backside of Hope's Pass or...
Exactly.
Because people get obsessed with heart rate and trail running, and it's like, you can, and it's a good thing to look at, but if you want to go uphill quickly in a race, you're going to have to like maybe just not look at that for a second.
Yeah.
Pretend like you didn't see that number and just let it ride.
Yeah. I mean, that's something I'm exploring letting happen, like letting my heart rate jump into a zone 3 or 4, knowing I have 6 hours left in a race, and saying, oh, is that going to bonk me out? Am I going to like release all this lactate and then get super heavy legs? And in the past that would happen to me, but I think now I'll be able to recover faster because of my like new diet.
It's interesting. I wish that this was my take. It seems like you're so well researched on these different like experiments. For me, I'm just like, oh, mentally I can suffer. So like because I have that mindset about myself, I feel like I cheat myself on experimenting with things like carbs and fats and different training methods. It's just like, oh no, I know.
You need a DNF. That's what you need.
Yeah. I've had some DNFs. I've had bad races. I had my last ultra in Nalula. I was trying to finish top 10 and came in 22nd, you know, not a good finish. Was puking in my mouth. The whole third and fourth lap. And you know, that was not a good race for me.
Yeah,
but I don't know, I just always I have this default mode of just like relying on the mental space, and maybe that's not always a good thing.
I think it's a great thing to have, like, and you know, I think I have that as well, but being able to also have physiology be able to support that is helpful. Like even in terms of mental clarity, which is like, I don't know, to me like the funniest term, like gaining more mental clarity. I didn't quite understand it until I started what I think is like producing more fat adaptation. Like I'm a little bit clearer. My inflammation's a little bit down. And I really noticed those things that when I heard people talk about it before, I'm like, that's bullshit. Like, how do you know that you're more mentally clear today?
Seems versus hard another. To
it's
quantify.
Hard to understand that.
Yeah.
But you have to feel it. So I have like a real feeling of, okay, if I eat a ton of carbs, I am a little bit foggier. I never knew because I didn't try anything different. Now I tried something different for a decent amount of time, and I feel different. And so like I like the way that it feels now better than before.
Yeah, it is such a hard thing to quantify. Like, am I mentally clear right now? Well, like I feel clear, like I'm able to sit in this conversation and express my thoughts, but what would being more clear feel like? And if you've never touched that, then you wouldn't be able to say whether or not you're there.
Totally. Yeah.
It's like the proof of heaven, right? It's like, is heaven there? It's like, I don't know, I've never been there.
Right.
But once you know, get to heaven, then you could say for sure heaven is real. And it's kind of like this this foggy mystery. It's like, is there actually another level of mental clarity that I could experience?
Yeah. I think there probably always will be different levels. Like, I used to teach some yoga and learning about the different like yogis and sadhus in India and like the things that they could do. Like, I think there's a lot of different things that can be expressed as human beings. And there's some that I'm willing to experiment with and some that I don't want to spend the time to experiment with. But for me, with my like weight loss goal, I wanted to see, okay, if I take these calories down, I have felt in my past like a struggle with overeating. And specifically overeating carbohydrates. I want to improve my endurance in these types of ways. I like eating fatty, protein-rich foods. Let me try this for 2 months. I know there's going to be an initial suffering period that, like, for me was 3 to 4 days. For some people, I heard it can be up to 2 weeks. But I'm like, cool. I'll just, whatever it is, I'm committing to that. And then it's paid off really well.
Mm. What are things that you've heard about, like you were saying, the yogis, things that you wouldn't experiment with, like things that have crossed your mind, but you're like, I'm not going down that path?
Just like long meditations for like extended period of time. Like I like the things I get to do in my life, and I am very curious naturally as a person, but there are certain things that take up too much time. Like, I can't meditate for 12 hours every single day. I mean, I guess I could, but then I would have to, you know, move out of the house I'm living in, probably wouldn't be able to keep my job, all of these other things. And so the benefits of like doing that aren't as enticing to me.
Yeah, that's a tough one. I think about that too, like the monk lifestyle. And I think we've had this conversation before because we've both been interested in the world of vision quests and long meditations. But for me, it's like, I have to put like a start and stop to it. Mm-hmm. So for me, I try to do like some kind of static vision quest twice a year biannually.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, that's really intense. I'm sure it gets like vision quests or long meditations get less intense if you're doing them every day, but like biannually, they're always very intense. And then by the end of it, I'm like, okay, I got so much out of that. And I'm so happy that my life is my life. And that is not my life every day.
Totally. Yeah.
It's a lot more challenging, I think, to be static than to live a dynamic life. Like, you might think that like being a high achiever is tough or being like a go-getter is something hard, but I think what's much harder than that is to sit in a circle and meditate for 12 hours a day.
Yeah, I think it's really difficult. I mean, the quest that I've done was three nights, 4 days with no food, just water in a wild place with no phones, no, like literally just a tarp and a sleeping bag and like some gallons of water. And it wasn't necessarily hard because I just knew that it was going to be that. So I could surrender to that experience.
Mm.
But if I had to do that, like, you know, for a month or something, and there was also other things that I felt like I needed to do, that could be difficult. But just recognizing like what is important at this period of my life. My old football coach had this great saying, like, it's called win, what's important now. Mm. And, you know, if I can focus on what's important for me now, whether that's like a spiritual quest or we're focusing on my diet or my endurance or my business or my relationships or family or whatever it is, I can just dive into that.
Mm-hmm. For your quest, were you guys all solo?
It was just me. Yeah, I was solo. And then my partner Kelly came, and the place that we were at, like in the morning, I would hike like a mile to this one specific spot, move a rock. And then the afternoon she would hike from where she was staying. That was like 4 miles away to that spot, move the rock back.
Right. So, you know, that everything's still okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. That I've used that system before. And it's the craziest thing because just to like see somebody else's existence and acknowledgement in that moment, you're like, oh, the rock is stacked. Everything's okay. I'm not like in some simulation. I'm just meditating in the woods and everything's fine.
Yeah.
Helps you like hold on to reality.
Yeah, it's weird how intense that stacking of the rocks can get, for sure.
Yeah, like sometimes you're like kind of far away from it or there's a stump in the way and you're like, oh my God, the rock, it's not stacked. Oh, Wait, no, okay, it's stacked. Okay, yeah. We're good. Everything's still normal.
Yeah, it became challenging for me to get to the rock at some point, because even though it's just a mile away, I wasn't having any food. And so and at that point, I was definitely not fat adapted. So I was like crashing like hard. And then, you know, just like get there. I couldn't see it from the spot that I was like stationed at.
I think that's an important thing to think about, though. Is we were talking about different ways to change your mental state. And I think fasting is such a good one, like especially in a vision quest kind of scenario. Like, you're able to get to thoughts and feelings that you can't get to when all of the stimulus is around and all the voices and all the food and all the McDonald's and the Subway and everything's always around and at your disposal. And then one day it's all gone and everything just is silent.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh my gosh, my brain is about to go wild.
That was probably the coolest thing I've ever done in terms of any type of strength lift or race or any challenge. That was definitely the most impactful for me because of the reason that you said. Like, I've lifted weights before. I've gone on runs. There's other people around. Like, there's so much stimulus in today's world that when you can eliminate that and be in the most honest place, which is nature, your honesty, your truth can come up. And so I'm a huge proponent of like rites of passage.
One of my mentors, Matt, he said that he thinks every world leader should have to do some kind of vision quest, solo vision quest, before they can take office. And I'm like, dang, that, because like you come out of that so centered and so grateful for the world around you, and you have a very good grasp on what's important and what's the noise.
Yeah.
And if you can't complete something like that, which I don't think a lot of people could in today's day and age, it shows that you need to work on some,
there's a problem.
You need to work on something and solve something inside of yourself.
I agree. Yeah, I mean, it probably sounds extreme, but if it's something that's really scary, it's worth asking yourself, why does that seem so scary? What am I holding on to that I don't want to release? And then what's the cost of holding on to that? And it's usually like your ability to connect with someone else, your ability to have to like go for a new job or role or something is holding you in this like fear-based defensive position.
Yeah, it is really, but on the bright side, there are cool things that happen. I had one in the mountains here where the shorter ones, I try not to sleep at night. I try to stay up during the night hours, just like fully experience it. And I was just sitting there, and all of a sudden I hear ruffling. And there was a mountain lion that was like camped out down below me, because the first spot I found, I was like, this is my spot. It's calling to me. It's speaking to me. I'm like about to set up my stuff. And then there's just huge partition poops. And I'm like, oh, okay. So this is, the mountain lion also likes this spot. I'm going to go up the hill. So I'm sitting there in the night, and I can hear the rustling, something coming up the hill. I'm like, all right, here it is. This is where I meet the mountain lion in the middle of the night. And out from the bushes comes a fox. And I was like, oh my God, thank God it's a fox. And so I'm just sitting there, and I had been peeing around my circle, trying to let the mountain lion know that I was up there and like make it very obvious. And I think the fox hadn't had enough salt. So it came up and just was smelling my pee and very interested in my pee. And to the point where he got like where my hand is to you.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, hey, like I'm right here. And you're about to like crawl into my lap. And I'm like, it's the middle of the night. I don't know if I'm seeing this in real life. I don't know what's going on. I'm just like, this is the craziest experience. And then he just kind of looked at me, and then he just walked away.
Wow.
And it was like one of the most magical moments I've ever had.
Yeah.
So super cool.
I mean, I think there's, I don't want these to sound doom or gloom at all. I think the quest was like the best thing that I've ever done, for sure. Like there, you don't know what's going to happen. And that's what is really difficult for people. Like, you have no idea you're going to have that experience with the fox.
No.
Or I have no idea of the experiences I would have, but they're really profound, and they can last into other areas. And I again encourage people to do some type of rite of passage.
Yeah, great things come from it. You'll have some hard moments too, and I think they're all really important.
The only great things happen from hard moments, which is just a reality. You can't
only
have anything great
things happen from hard moments. Okay. From the wise sage Mike Idala. I like that. Only great things happen from hard moments. I think there's a lot of truth to that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's all I mean, think about anything great in your life, like that came from you doing something challenging, difficult, hard.
Mm. It's very true.
Yeah. But so it, my opinion is we need to focus on building the emotional and mental strength to do, to like withstand hard things so we can have the great moments.
Mm.
And so many of us want the great moments, but we're scared or we don't have the strength to withstand the hard times.
Mm-hmm.
And so we don't actually get these moments. And instead of focusing on this, focusing on building that mental resiliency and emotional strength so that they don't destroy you and you know you can work through them. Like you've done an amazing job at, like, you know,
thanks, man,
that something's going to be difficult, but it's not going to destroy you. It's not going to, like, you're not going to die. Right? It may be challenging, but that challenge is the only way to, you know, move over towards that, you know, one of the best moments of your life.
Yeah. And you always got to, you got to touch base with yourself, because sometimes it does feel like you're going to die or like you're going to, everything's going to be over. But then you like kind of step back and think about it, like, am I going to die? Is it actually all over? Wait, no, we're all right. We're good.
Yeah.
I got two arms. I got my legs still. Everything's working.
Yeah. And there's different levels too. Like, you know, you've been doing this for a long time. I've been doing it for a little bit of time. Like, I won't just, if someone's never ran before, I wouldn't say just like go jump into an ultra marathon. Like, there's the challenge skills balance that I love to talk about, which is like on one axis is the challenge that's ahead of you, and on the other is the skill. And so if your mental resiliency is really low, then you don't have a lot of that skill. You got to make sure the challenge is appropriate for the skill you have. Otherwise, you'll be anxious. It'd be way too much. You won't feel successful. But if it's too easy, then you're going to be bored.
Mm-hmm.
And so finding that appropriate challenge for the skill level you're at is really the art in all of this kind of game, and a lot of the work that I will do with the offense with people.
Because that's kind of the meaning behind flow, right? It's like when my ability and my experience, my culmination of talents meets a hard challenge,
yeah,
and I'm able to conquer it. And what you just said, I had never thought of it like that, but if it's too easy, you won't be in flow.
No.
Like if you're riding a bike down the street and you're going 5 miles an hour and you're just kind of pedaling on a cruiser, you're probably not going to find flow state. You're probably going to be having a good time, but you're not going to be like truly locked in. You're going to be thinking about what's for breakfast. Oh, there's a new smoothie shop. Like, you're not going to be totally locked into that moment.
And that's what it's like, playing it too easy. Like, again, the defense of life, because it's hard to push, to challenge yourself. And I think a lot of people do that. Like, I just see it a lot with my clients. Like, if they're feeling anxious or overwhelmed, it's not, it, usually the case can be they don't have something big enough in their life to pull them up into that flow state. And so I'd really like to encourage people to dream big and to go for something that requires a lot of your energy and a lot of your effort, because it will kind of put things into perspective. You won't get upset about the traffic or you know some comment someone made about your t-shirt. Like, you're like, okay, cool, those things don't really matter because I'm focusing on, you know, my first whatever it is I'm going to be doing.
Yeah, that's why I love the 365 day calendar, because you can like just put things out in the future and just be like, okay, here is something I'm looking forward to. Like, there's a couple things on there that scare the absolute shit out of me.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just like, all right, how am I progressing towards these goals and making sure that I'm prepared? Like, one of them, the Teton Picnic, I have to do 2 cold water swims across Jenny Lake and Tetons as part of that. And I am not a swimmer. So I'm like trying to figure out, I've surfed for a long time, so I have the power, but I don't have the breathing down.
Mm.
I got to figure out the breathing. And that is like something that's been going through my head. It's like, dude, you really got to learn to swim like soon. Like, it's coming up.
Yeah.
So having those things out in front of you, like, they give you something to work towards.
Totally. Yeah. I think men specifically need a mission. Like, I'm just speaking because I'm a man, but that is something that if you don't have that and it's not really motivating to you, then you're, the skill isn't, or the challenge isn't high enough, and you're gonna feel that anxiety or that boredom or that like malaise of just like, eh, if things are okay.
Mm.
And it takes effort to, it comes naturally, I think, to you and I to like think of these goals and push ourselves in these ways, but that is something we've been practicing for a long time. That's a skill in itself. And at least a lot of the people that I chat with, that's not something that's natural for them. They have been taught maybe like a rule book or a playbook of just going through the motions in some way, and then I'll be successful, and then I'll have this certain type of life. And to break through that takes a lot of like conscious energy and effort, because you're going against your own identity or your old identity.
That's true. If folks want to hear more, because I'm sure there's a lot of people that are going to resonate with that last part, especially a lot of people I know, like names were popping in my head as you were saying that. If folks resonate with that, how do they learn more about the offense and kind of the stuff you have going on?
Yeah, they can go to theoffense.co or start a new Instagram for the offense. So it's just the.offense. And you can DM me or email me at michael.idella@gmail.com.
Sweet, man. Well, I had a great time talking to you as always, and I look forward to sharing the trail with you this year, man.
Yeah, heck yeah. I'll have to get up on some training runs soon.
Yeah, I'm down. All right, see you guys next time. Stay wild.